From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, an unlikely showdown between, on one side, mom-and-pop bookstores, Barnes & Noble and Walmart, and on the other, the world's largest online retailer and honed and highlighted self-help guru, Tim Ferriss.
The four-hour work week is possible, but you need to completely unplug and reset.
That's Ferriss on a previous bestseller, The 4-Hour Work Week. Ferriss's books have sold over 2 million copies combined, which is why Amazon signed him this year to a reported seven-figure contract. Amazon released his latest, The 4-Hour Chef, this past Tuesday, enabling Ferriss to bypass traditional publishers and cut those dinosaurs out of the supply chain.
Getting rid of everything, all the static, all the noise, all the interruptions that interfere with getting you to that ideal lifestyle.
But those dinosaurs decline to play dead. Instead, they are largely refusing to display or in many cases even sell the new book. The showdown underscores a moment when publishing seems either on the brink of collapse or reinvention.
Forget about what's popular and really look at what works and what is consuming your time.
Now, booksellers don't not sell books. In the 1970s, they stocked Nixon's memoirs despite protests, and in the 80s, they stocked the Satanic Verses despite bomb threats. I ask New York Times reporter David Streitfeld, who covers the industry, what makes Tim Ferriss so special?
It's nothing personal about Ferriss, but Ferriss is the first time that Amazon is really making a major effort to have a major bestseller. They want that book to sell not only digitally, but in its physical version. And so this is the first time the booksellers have really had an opportunity to hit back against Amazon.
But Amazon can sell the physical book just as easily as it would sell a digital one.
Maybe not just as easily. For all of the great things that Amazon does, it gets you the book 2 days later or the next day if you really want it. It allows you to read the first chapter, it sells it at a discount, it still cannot put the book in your hands and allow you to page through it. That's something that only a physical bookseller can do.
You said it wasn't personal against Timothy Ferriss, but isn't it just a little?
Just a little in the sense that they're upset that he has aligned himself with their enemy, Amazon. The booksellers feel that they were responsible for helping make Tim Ferriss a big success.
Crown specifically, a division of Random House?
Right. Crown took him on when I think 24 publishers had turned him down, and they put a major effort into it. And now the booksellers feel that Ferriss has abandoned Crown and them to reinvent publishing, as he said. They don't particularly want publishing reinvented.
Is this just symbolic, or do you think this could actually work?
Tim Ferriss has a great desire to be a huge bestseller. He has a lot of ideas, and so he will work triply hard to make this book work. Amazon does not want to be embarrassed here, and so it will work triply hard to make this work. But I still think however many copies the book ends up selling, either digitally or in physical form, it would have sold more with the bookseller's support.
David Streitfeld is a reporter for the New York Times. However things turn out for Ferriss's 4-Hour Chef, the publishing industry is convulsing. Just as Hurricane Sandy approached New York City, Penguin and Random House, two of the big six publishing houses, announced that they would become one.
To mark the moment, we're updating and rebroadcasting our hour first aired this spring on the state of the book business. One caveat, you'll hear some of our guests refer to the big six publishing houses. That number, as we've just mentioned, has since been reduced by one. But the trends remain the same. Bookstore sales continued their downward slide. And though last year's ebook sales soared, they're still just taking a larger slice of an ever-shrinking revenue pie.
Meanwhile, the four remaining non-merged houses are still grappling with the impact of a lawsuit filed this year by the Justice Department. The DOJ sued publishers for attempting to seize back control of book pricing from Amazon. The settlement that resulted broke the back of their united effort to keep Amazon from undercutting them by selling books at impossibly low prices. More on that later. Mike Schatzkin, head of the Idealogical Company, a publishing consulting firm, says publishers need a new value proposition. It used to be,
we can put books on shelves. And for 100 years, that's been a great business. It is not going to be a great business for the next 10 years. It's going to get worse and worse. They're going to have to find some other value propositions.
Like what?
You can't just publish any subject that comes along and let the bookstore sort out who the right customer is. You have to think about what areas you're going to publish in, and you have to publish in those areas over and over again so you know those communities and those communities know you. You add flexibility to sell them things that you might otherwise not have been able to sell them before that are related. So conferences, for example, or there's a publisher called Osprey, which does military. And you build up enough of a direct connection with people who are interested in military history, you can sell them battlefield tours, not just books. And that's the future. The future is siloed by interest.
What happens if you publish literary fiction?
Then you're that's going to be the hardest kind of stuff to do.
You were about to say, then you're screwed.
I wasn't going to say you're screwed. But I would say this. In the 1830s and 1840s, the most popular American writers were poets. And the reason for that is literacy was low. People wanted to buy a book that a bunch of people could enjoy by somebody reading it out loud to them. By the 1880s, public education had solved that problem. And poets didn't do as well, and novelists did better. Now, one of the things that's been happening because of the ebook revolution is that genre fiction, romance, thriller, sci-fi, has done very well because a lot of people eat them like candy. The establishment can't keep their habit fed, so they're willing to try something different and new, particularly if it's cheap. The successful self-published writers have all been in genres. They haven't been literary fiction, and they haven't been writing biographies of Steve Jobs, for example. That book has got to cost $500,000 to write. You've got a serious journalist spending several years trying to do this with a research team. There's no way that a book like that gets written unless some publisher or somebody writes a check for $500,000 or $1 million.
If Walter Isaacson can't get paid what he needs to write the biography of Steve Jobs, a guaranteed bestseller, then the problem is that the public doesn't want it enough. Not that Amazon is driving down the prices of ebooks.
No, that's actually just not true, because you now have a market which is bifurcated, and you have lots and lots of books, most of the branded books that are between $10 and $15, and they yield revenue of X, which actually would support Walter Isaacson. And you have lots and lots and lots of books that are $1, $2, and $3, and some of those are selling a lot of copies. So what happens in this new economy that we're in is that the total amount of revenue generated by bestsellers drops precipitously, and Amazon doesn't care about that. If we lose major publishers, what we will lose is the books that won't even be written.
Mike, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
Mike Schatzkin heads the Idealogical Company, a publishing industry consulting firm.
For a literary fiction industry in freefall, one reliable source of good news is always the announcement of the Pulitzer Prize. That's because the Pulitzer has developed a reputation for finding a balance between the critics' darlings and popular fiction. So this year it came as a shock when the Pulitzer winners were announced and the prize for fiction went to nobody. After all, it's been 35 years since the last time the Pulitzer Board declined to award the fiction prize. Author, Salon senior writer, and past Pulitzer judge Laura Miller says that it's a shame because no other award cuts through a balkanized literary world that can find precious little to agree on.
That's a great thing to have, a yearly reminder that literary fiction is not this completely impenetrable art form.
Tell me, please, about the process.
Well, there's a jury of three people. Usually it's a critic, an academic, and a novelist of some kind. And they read the vast majority of the submissions. I mean, anybody can send in their book with, I think it's $50, and really anybody does. And then they come up with three finalists. Ultimately, the board decides who the final winner is.
They do have that power to discard the recommendations of the poor schnooks who each read 300 books.
They do.
To choose one of their own liking. But they clearly didn't avail themselves of that option this time.
No, and they haven't for a while, though they did do it three times in the 70s, which will give you a sense of how contested the idea of literary quality was in that particular era.
So maybe the explanation really is just in the procedures of the Pulitzer Board, but is it possible that there's a larger explanation? You mentioned balkanization.
Yes. The reason why I use the term balkanization is because that is fragmentation plus acrimony. And so even when you have a book, as in The Year Before Last with Jonathan Franzen's Freedom, that a lot of people are saying, okay, this is the big unifying novel, there is actually a substantial fragment of the literary fiction reading world that automatically hates any novel that's declared the great American novel.
Does literary fiction as a genre recover from this? Is it getting close to being irrelevant?
We are coming out of a mid-20th century period where every educated person felt that it was expected of them to at least have read some of the most celebrated literary novels of the year. And people just don't feel that way anymore. And we could see this award as symptomatic of that.
Laura, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Laura Miller is a senior writer at Salon.
Oh, Jane Austen, I like your books. It is so fun to read them. They teach me all about what it was like for a woman in 18th century England.
This is On the Media.
Actually, I think it's 19th century.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. At the beginning of the show, I mentioned this year's Justice Department antitrust lawsuit, which charged Hachette, HarperCollins, Simon & Schuster, Macmillan, Penguin, and Apple with conspiring to fix book prices. What they actually did was conspire to wrest control of book pricing from Amazon. Amazon draws customers to its site with rock-bottom book prices, hoping that they might stay to buy other products. The publishers didn't want Amazon's price points to become the industry standard. Instead, they wanted to set the prices for the retailer. It's called agency pricing. And one prominent retailer, Apple, agreed. So they all suffered a big defeat to Amazon when the Justice Department settled with three of the publishers, who promised to cease conspiring with other publishers in agency pricing. But one of those publishing companies, Macmillan, and Apple will proceed to court. Barry C. Lynn, senior fellow at the New America Foundation, believes that while the Department of Justice followed the letter of the law, it missed its spirit.
They were discussing creating a pricing policy. That's very different than sort of creating a scheme to raise prices. And one of the things that people haven't focused on a lot here is that in the overall price of ebooks, between December of 2010 and 2011, went down by maybe 20%. What we want to protect here is a marketplace where you have many, many, many suppliers of books, writers of books, editors of books, and you want as much as possible to have no large powers in between the writer and the reader interfering with the marketplace.
But haven't there always been large powers standing between the reader and the marketplace in the form of large publishers?
We don't want to at any point say we're going to protect the big six publishers. What we would ideally want is to go back to what we had in the late 1970s. which is a system in which you had no dominant publishers and you had no dominant retailers.
Okay, so what happened in the 1970s and 80s? What was the situation before and why did it change?
Going back to 1773, to the Tea Party, which was an action against the British East India Company, we used our anti-monopoly laws to distribute power so that no one had the ability to dictate to us as citizens. What happened in the late 1970s and 1980s is this really weird coalition of the consumerist far left and the libertarian far right came together and said, let's get rid of that old model. What we want to do now is make a system that yields more efficiencies so that it will benefit the consumer in the form of lower prices. So we took the very lessons that the United States was founded upon and that kept us free as a people for 200 years, and we threw it out.
The Justice Department was much more concerned about the collusion than about the pricing scheme. As a result, the biggest publisher using agency pricing, Random House, which was not involved in the actual conspiracy, according to DOJ, is free to go ahead and pursue agency pricing.
They are free to go ahead, technically. The problem is that unless everyone's doing it at the same time, no one's going to do it.
In the game Monopoly, one of the monopolies you can buy is a railroad. And you've likened what's going on in publishing to the railroad in days of yore.
In the 19th century, these new technologies, the railroad, the telegraph, allowed a few people to capture control over most industry in the United States. The new railroads, the internet, Amazon being probably right now commercially the foremost player. One of the ways that you neutralize railways is you prevented them from owning other lines of business, like quarries or oil wells. Because if you allow them to own other lines of business, they will favor their own lines of business. Right now, Amazon, we allow them to vertically integrate. We allow them to own publishing operations, to favor what they publish and to disfavor what other people publish. Over time, this leads in one inexorable direction, which is towards complete control over this system by a single group of human beings.
Isn't it true that when Amazon underprices, it isn't cutting into the publisher's share? The publisher gets a certain amount regardless of how low Amazon sets the price for the book, right?
They get a certain amount, absolutely. The problem is 6 months from now, 12 months from now, if a reader was accustomed to spending $19.99 and then Amazon accustoms them to pay $9.99 or $8.99, even if the publishers this year are getting $12.99 at wholesale, next year they're going to get less because there's a new price in the marketplace and their share of that will be some fraction of the new price.
So what are you arguing here, that Amazon is going to kill the book industry with its low pricing? Why would it do that? That would be suicidal.
They actually don't really care that much about the book industry. Amazon wants to sell televisions. Amazon wants to sell shoes. They can lose money on books forever, throw them out the front door as a form of candy to lure us, the consumers, into their realm so that they know who we are, know what we like to buy, and then sell us all these other things forevermore.
So do you think in 40 years the Monopoly Board will have an Amazon square?
Actually, we probably won't because most of the Monopoly games will be sold across Amazon, and I assume they won't allow that to happen.
Barry C. Lynn, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me today.
Barry C. Lynn is a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. Just a reminder, when we recorded that interview earlier this year, Random House and Penguin had not yet merged, expanding their market power. We don't know what impact that will have, but Matthew Ingram, a senior writer with the website GigaOM, says the publisher's efforts to tame Amazon are doomed to fail.
I think in some ways they are trying to play King Canute.
King Canute?
Yeah, King Canute was the one who tried to stop the tides. There's some debate about whether he was just an idiot or whether he was trying to show people that you couldn't do that.
You think that King Canute could apply to the publishing industry?
They are trying to halt something that can't be halted.
You know that overall book sales are falling. I'm not blaming Amazon for this, but there is a problem.
But are higher prices going to solve that problem? How is that going to help? I know these are just small examples, but if you look at self-publishers like J.A. Conrath, when he dropped the price to 99 cents, he sold 10 times, 20 times, 30 times more books. You know, Amanda Hawking, she's a self-publishing phenomenon. She made, I think, close to $2 million in under a year by self-publishing through the Kindle platform. By selling short books, not incredibly well-written books, 99 cents. How well-written does it need to be for 99 cents?
But haven't you sort of implicitly made the point that quality costs? What about the kinds of advances that publishers lay out to get authors that may be really good?
I'm not saying that publishers don't provide value. I think they do. But now, I think they need to show what that value is. A good editor and a relationship that a writer has with that editor is a hugely valuable thing, something that Amazon, at least so far, isn't providing. But that's no longer the default.
A lot of critics think that the Department of Justice has inadvertently strengthened Amazon's monopoly in its decision, which was intended to be anti-monopoly.
Amazon's monopoly has actually decreased from about 90% or so to, I think, the 60% range. Now, I know the publishers would like to argue that that's because of agency pricing. I think it's probably in spite of agency pricing. Ebooks haven't even existed for that long. Amazon effectively created that market and has, you know, the leading e-reader. So obviously it's going to have a huge market share. But I think over time that is going to decrease. It almost always does.
Talk to me about how digital rights management, DRM, figures into this whole argument.
Okay, sure. So digital rights management is anything that protects the content in some way, prevents you from moving it to another device, prevents you from copying it. There was a fantastic column, I think Charlie Strauss wrote it, the science fiction author, about DRM. And his argument was that by agreeing to restrictive DRM, whether it's Amazon's or Apple's, authors and publishers effectively gave Amazon a giant stick to beat them with.
I don't understand.
Well, DRM locks those books into Amazon's platform, right? You buy a Kindle, you buy your books through Amazon, you can only read them on your Kindle.
But you have to have one format or another.
Sure, but you should have as many different formats as possible. So, in fact, there is a publisher who is pretty much doing that. O'Reilly has no DRM on any of its books. And Tim O'Reilly has said that, you know, piracy is this huge boogeyman that everybody talks about. Our books are going to be pirated. In some cases, you actually want your books to be pirated. It's how people find your content. Paulo Coelho, the Brazilian author, pirated his own books, uploaded them to BitTorrent servers so that he could broaden his reach into new markets. Never told his publisher. But of course, you know, now he has 3 million readers in Russia, and his publisher thinks that's fantastic.
So if you were talking to the big six publishers now, what would you advise them to do?
I would say reduce your costs.
Fire your editors?
Not necessarily. God knows there's got to be some fat in the publishing business.
What else?
Get rid of DRM.
Would you advise them to just sit back, think of England while Amazon sets the prices?
No, of course not. I mean, they have to negotiate with Amazon.
But Amazon holds all the cards.
Amazon doesn't hold all the cards. Amazon doesn't have all the content. It wants that content so that it can offer it to people on its platform. Push Amazon to give up on DRM. They want it just as badly as the publishers did. Instead of trying to protect a specific price point, think about what your business is going to look like in 5 years or 10 years, and how can you get there?
Matthew, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Matthew Ingram is a senior writer at the technology website GigaOM. Now, publishing consultant Mike Schatzkin, you heard him about 20 minutes ago, offers us a tale about an author so wise and so powerful that she somehow retained the digital rights for her books, standing up to Amazon. J.K. Rowling dubbed it Pottermore.
What she did was she said, we are perfectly happy to sell our ebooks without any digital locks. But what we will do is watermark it. So if that copy ends up on a pirate site, we're going to know it was your copy that ended up there. It's called social digital rights management, or social DRM, which is to say, I'm going to threaten you with shame or maybe litigation, but I'm going to know it was your copy that went to a pirate site. By doing that, unless Amazon played ball with Pottermore, Pottermore would just sell Kindle-compatible ebooks off their own site, which is essentially what they're doing. And what it forced Amazon to do is to turn the Potter customers over to Pottermore so that Pottermore gets to register them and know who they are.
So what did Amazon give up in this equation?
The monopoly on the customer information. As a matter of fact, I don't know what information Amazon gets about the customer. That's a negotiation between Pottermore and Amazon. But the customer, rather than buying from Amazon, buys from Pottermore. And as a result, Pottermore captures all the data on that customer and the ability to solicit them for other things in the future. It's a very, very powerful change.
So there's the valuable commodity of customer information. And also, doesn't J.K. Rowling get to set the price?
Yes.
Okay, so why don't other publishers go this route?
If a medium-sized publisher said, we're going to do what Pottermore's done, I think Amazon would just take their books off the site rather than collaborate with them. But Amazon couldn't be put in a position where a Harry Potter book was out and you couldn't find it on their website. They just couldn't do that without hurting themselves more than they hurt anybody else. So they're not doing that. If the big publishers went to a Pottermore solution, I think we'd see a very, very interesting battle in the industry.
Mike Schatzkin, head of the Idealogical Company.
This book is so awesome. I can do anything. This book is so awesome. I am the potions king. Did you hear that, Half-Blood Prince? I said I was the king. Can you hear me, Professor Snape? I can make anything. This book is so awesome.
Because of its vast size and clout, Amazon scares the bejeebers out of most publishers, even big ones. But there is one very, very small publisher that seems to be fearless. Earlier this year, Randall White of the Educational Development Corporation pulled all of his company's books from Amazon in protest of the company's business tactics. Educational Development publishes educational books for children. Its biggest seller is a reassuring message to self-conscious youngsters.
The title sold the most is Everyone Poops. Sold over a million copies. But we do have great books, educational, science, history, nature, and foreign language. But Everyone Poops is our number one seller.
You sell through bookstores, but you have a big direct sales component, kind of like Tupperware parties. Tell me about it.
We have around 7,000 ladies who sell books through the direct selling method. They can do fundraisers in schools, book fairs, home parties. So these are independent consultants working out of their house. It's a very powerful sales force, though. And what's happening now with so many smartphones, they'll make their sales presentation, and among oohs and ahs on how wonderful the product is, pop out that smartphone and go, well, I can get that cheaper on Amazon. Well, there's a basic rule of sales, and that is whoever makes a sale has to get paid or they quit. It really came down to one individual lady. She went into a school who had never seen our products before, presented them to them, and the school went, wow, I like these. And the next day, she went back in to pick up the order, and they had bought it from Amazon. And so that day, I just decided, I've got to do something better.
So is it easy to get out of the Amazon ecosystem?
We didn't sell directly to Amazon. We sold through a large distributor, Baker & Taylor. So I was in touch with Baker & Taylor and told them, really, they're killing my business. But they were such a big part of Baker & Taylor that they said, well, too bad. So I had to terminate the entire Baker & Taylor account, which is substantial for us.
And a very expensive decision for you, at least at first blush. How has it worked out?
An article was written by us in the New York Times. I have been overwhelmed with the response just because of that article. From individuals, stores, other publishing companies, other people in industries, not even ours, music industry, that have called me and said, congratulations, that took some big ones. A guy called me who was vice president of a regional chain with 65 stores and said, thanks for standing up for retail stores. As it turns out, we've been trying to get in his chain, and that day we opened the account. So I can't tell you how heartwarming it is for the public to support us in this decision.
But I have to ask you whether what you've done indicates that David can defeat Goliath, or whether it indicates that what you're really protecting is a business model that just doesn't work in an internet world.
There is a company that we are very familiar with that started 7 years ago, and they sell only in the direct selling method. And in 7 years, they've built 500 million annual sales. That doesn't sound like a dead channel to me. The problem is you can't have a woman sell to her friends and the next day find it cheaper someplace else because they think their friend has cheated them.
What's going to happen?
Well, I believe our 7,000 ladies are going to be so happy now that I've untied one hand behind her back that they're going to talk a friend into joining them, and we're going to have 14,000 people selling books, and our sales are going to double. That's what can happen if you get it right.
All right, man. Well, thank you very, very much.
Okay, thanks.
Educational Development Corporation President Randall White. His company continues to boycott Amazon.
Coming up, how serendipity saved Moby Dick.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at JoyceFDN.org. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at MelvilleTrust.org. And the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence. At thescanfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Buying a cheap knockoff is not just a problem with watches and handbags. Increasingly, knockoff books are being made. If you go onto Amazon's website, for example, to purchase Stieg Larsson's best-selling The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, you might stumble upon I Am the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, a completely unrelated book self-published on Amazon through its Create Space imprint. Fortune senior editor Stephen Gandell looked into the knockoffs on Amazon and found a number of the books that he says were clearly meant to confuse people by trading off of more popular titles.
There was Steve Jobs by Isaac Worthington, which sounds a lot like the book that's very popular now, Steve Jobs by Walter Isaacson. There was also 35 Shades of Grey by J.D. Light, which sounds a lot like 50 Shades of Grey, also by a two-initial author, E.L. James. There's a very well-selling book by a Nobel Prize-winning economist called Thinking Fast and Slow. Amazon, until recently, was selling a book called Fast and Slow Thinking. There's What to Expect When You're Expecting. And if you buy this book, you probably won't get the book you're expecting because it's not the very popular book.
But that's an actual title.
It's a book by someone else by the exact same title.
So if you get suckered into buying 35 Shades of Grey by J.D. Light, who in all probability doesn't exist, what do you get?
You get a book that's more like a pamphlet. It's not nearly as long as the real book. And most of these books that are knockoff books are printed in a very weird format. They're usually very large type, like Steve Jobs by Isaac Worthington, not the right book. It had about 40 words per page. There were huge words on each page, about 2 words per line. And it looked like the material was rewritten from the Wikipedia page. It followed the kind of outline of what's on the Wikipedia page. The reviewer for that book said, do not buy this book. This is a pamphlet. It looks like something that would be handed to you on a street corner.
You spoke to the author of I Am the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, not the late Stieg Larsson, but a woman named Karen Peebles, who claims to have written 10,000 books and published them through Amazon's Create Space.
She said she was a stay-at-home mom who homeschools her children, and this was a good way for her to get nice royalty checks with not having to leave the house. But I said to her, you know, there's this other very popular book that is called The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and she said that when she wrote her book, she hadn't heard of it, but she wrote her book in 2008, well after the book was already internationally famous, and she chose not to publish it through Amazon until mid-2010. Well-timed for the popularity of the book in the U.S. It seems less than coincidental.
Let's talk about the system that allows this scam to take place. The titles were published through this Amazon CreateSpace software. how is it that Amazon cannot filter out obvious, non-serious publishing content?
The comeback Amazon would have and say, well, we're not really the publisher. We're just distributing these self-publishing books. They don't have a real publishing relationship in the way the book industry thinks about them. Amazon doesn't acquire the rights to the books. They don't edit them. But to the average consumer, there's no way to know. When you go on the website, CreateSpace, Amazon's division is listed as the publisher. It should say the person's name there for the publisher if it's really a self-published book. But it doesn't. It has this CreateSpace label that makes you think, oh, I'm getting a real book, when what you're getting is not.
Has anyone committed a crime?
Titles of books are not copyrighted. So there's a gray line here. And there is a book titled The Dragon with the Girl Tattoo. You're able to sell that. I mean, clearly that's a parody and a new kind of work. When you're just trying to trick the consumer into buying your book because they think it's that other book, then that's illegal.
You know what, Steve? You should write a book about this very thing, and I know exactly what you should call it.
Lay it on me.
Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone.
I'm on it.
Stephen, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Stephen Gandel is a senior editor at Fortune magazine. In Russia, book pirating is rampant. In fact, Russians have access to more than 100,000 pirated e-books and just 60,000 legitimate ones. For many authors and publishers, that is simply infuriating. After all, they're deprived of the sales revenues from their own property, and that often leads to lawyers getting involved. But when Peter Mountford, author of A Young Man's Guide to Late Capitalism, realized his book was being translated for a pirate Russian publisher, he did not hire a lawyer. No, he realized that this was something he had to take into his own hands. And that he did. He located the illicit translator online and helped him translate the novel, which is premised on a young man who's taken a job at a rapacious hedge fund.
He goes to Bolivia at the time of the election of Evo Morales, and his task is to see if he can parlay the election into something that the hedge fund can make money on.
Which is funny in the first instance, because Evo Morales is a socialist Hugo Chavez wannabe, right?
Exactly. In the process, he has a love affair with Evo Morales' press liaison, and hijinks ensue.
I haven't read it, but I'm sure it is delightful. And at least one Russian thought so, too. Tell me about the first hint you had that your book was in play in an unlawful way.
I had had a Google alert on the title of the book. And so over the course of the year after it was published, the Google alert started having less hits. And then I started to get a lot of hits from this Russian guy on a word reference forum online who was asking many, many questions about what I meant in all sorts of sentences in the opening of the book. And I thought he was just a very eager Russian reader.
For example, you used the term cucumber walls to describe a pale green color, but this threw him.
He was really baffled, and he thought I might have meant that the walls were the texture of cucumber, or possibly, sort of inexplicably, he thought it might mean that the walls were paisley, which was really, really strange. And he asked this question.
Well, cucumber-shaped.
Yeah, exactly.
I can see why he might have guessed paisley.
I said a person was not towing the party line, and he thought that meant the person wasn't enjoying an actual party. I said somebody was suffering from white liberal guilt, and he said, does that mean the guilt that a person feels from doing cocaine? And then he said to somebody, I'm translating it for a Russian publisher. I'm not just a normal reader. And that's when it occurred to me that he was a Russian pirate translator. He wasn't translating it on spec or anything. He was actually translating the entire book for somebody.
And then you started going back and forth with him? I mean, isn't that like driving up to your house and seeing a burglar trying to jimmy your windows and then grabbing your tire iron to help him? I don't get it.
The book had been out for a year, so the official Russian publishers had had opportunities to acquire the rights, and they had not made a move to do so. And so I was faced with the option of either having it pirated and published, and I wouldn't make any money on it, but at least people would read the book in Russian, or I could try and sort of put up a fight and stop the pirate translation, and then I would not only not make money, but nobody would read the book in Russian. And I thought that if the translation was going to be good, I might need to intervene. And so I sent him an email and said, hi, as the author of the book, I think I'm uniquely qualified to help you with this. And then after 2 weeks, to my surprise and delight, he wrote to me and said, thank you for contacting me. I would love to have your help. And there ensued this just barrage of questions. I've had hundreds of questions from him. And my wife was very stern with me and said, you cannot spend a lot of time on this. You're not getting paid for it. And so I've been dashing off my responses.
Can you give me an example of the exchanges?
At one point, I described a character as being, you know, I said, reportedly a lethal diplomatic sniper. He was instead armed with a blunderbuss. And Alexander was totally baffled. He said, reportedly, he was a brilliant diplomatic sniper using his charm to hit from the first go and win people's hearts of the people whose cooperation he needed, but actually, and then it goes on and on and on, unsuitable for sharp shooting. He had a harbiscus, harbicus.
You call him Alexander, you know, as opposed to whatever his last name is, or that guy, or worse. Mm-hmm. What is your relationship with him? Are you friends? Are you colleagues? Are you adversaries?
Definitely colleagues. It's been cordial all along. We've never talked, I mean, almost never talked about the business aspect of it. We just talk about the text. Although, when I published this piece in The Atlantic, there was an article in The Guardian. And as a result, he finally got wind of it. And he wrote me a very awkward email saying, I am not a thief. I basically said, evidence seems to indicate that you are, but I've enjoyed working with you. And we have since then, after he sent me this awkward email, we've continued to correspond about the translation. He has never asked me anything whatsoever about my life. It did come up for some reason that he is actually a biologist and he moonlights as a translator. At one point, he put the translation on hold because he had to take a very long train ride somewhere. I don't remember where. But he said, I'm going to be on the train for the next couple of days, so no work.
I want to ask you one final thing, Peter. You referred earlier to choices you had, whether to protect your intellectual property or to see that your work reaches ever wider audiences. And you suggested that it was an either-or proposition. Many have argued that piracy actually, in addition to increasing your audience of freeloaders, also increases your audience of paid buyers. We've learned this from the music industry, that some percentage of people who become aware of your work will actually pony up at a legitimate retailer.
I've heard Neil Gaiman say that exact point, where he has his book published legitimately and pirated in Russia. And he feels that the pirated version bolsters the sales of the legitimate version. I hope that that is true.
Are you done with each other? Is this it between Alexander and you?
I hope that we're not done with each other. I hope that he works on my next novel, which will be published in 2014. I would love to have an official Russian translation, and maybe he can help make that happen by getting my name out in Russia.
Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Peter Mountford is the author of A Young Man's Guide to Late Capitalism.
As we've heard, freelance thieves can potentially affect the fate of a book. But let us, before we end the hour, recall that publishers can and do have an impact on literary destiny. As a newly minted editorial assistant at Norton, writer Tom Bissell was able to resuscitate an out-of-print novel called Desperate Characters by Paula Fox. Bissell convinced Norton to republish Fox's book, reviving her career. In his book, Magic Hours, Bissell writes that the experience shook his faith in books. Tom, welcome back to the show.
It's always great to be here with you.
The faith that I'm talking about was your belief in the power of great art to rise above, quote, base commerce and sheer indifference and live.
What shook my faith was the idea that suddenly I was somehow the most important part of this process. And I think processes seem much more reassuring when you're not part of them.
And your experience showed how random events can rule the destinies of the greatest works of art. You cite the novels of Kafka.
Kafka asked for all of his work to be burned. One of the two people he told to burn his work did it. The other did not. Now, if Max Brod, the guy who did not burn Kafka's work, had, as I put it, loved him enough to take his plea to him seriously, you know, we would have lost one of the most emblematic writers of the 20th century. In the case of Paula Fox, this was a writer who was completely out of print. I was an editorial assistant at a house that was not known for encouraging its editorial assistants to propose reprints of out-of-print novels. And yet on the day that I brought the book up, I remember everyone was in a kind of a good mood. Everyone just seemed sort of happy that meeting.
It could have been the barometer or a particularly tasty lunch or your personality.
It could have been any one of those things. And the fact that the book took off launching Paula back into literary consciousness, she's really recognized as one of the most significant post-war writers. All these chance events that led up to my even knowing of that book and then that gave me the strange confidence to propose this to my colleagues, it freaked me out a little bit. It made me realize how fragile these processes are.
And is that why in your essay you traced the tenuous fates of three writers that we might never have heard of or certainly not remembered, Walt Whitman, Herman Melville, and Emily Dickinson?
Now, of the three, Walt Whitman's survival was the least surprising because he was always a pretty famous writer, but I think amongst the literary tastemakers of his day, he was regarded as a bit of a joke. And he certainly wrote a lot of poems that encouraged them in that thinking. And he was such a shameless self-promoter that I think people kind of got really sick of him. So in Whitman's case, I think it was when all the people who knew him personally were dead. That, you know, that allowed people who didn't remember what a self-promoting ass he could be from time to time that they were able to go back to his work and rediscover it.
And what about Herman Melville?
Melville is the one that I think should keep novelists up at night. Who, you know, he had two very early successes, which were published as nonfiction, but in fact were very heavily fictionalized accounts of his life in Fiji. And they were very successful, and he sort of set himself to change the game. And he wrote this massive, incredibly weird, ambitious novel, unlike any novel anyone had ever written before, Moby Dick. And it was a resounding unsuccess. It sold 3,000 copies over its 36 years in print.
And so how did he come roaring back and become enshrined in the canon?
The one Melville resuscitation attempt that stuck was Carl Van Doren, a very influential American critic. And he, according to the legend, found a copy of Moby Dick in a used bookstore, went home, read it, was so blown away that this book had like completely vanished from literary consciousness, and he wrote an essay about it. D.H. Lawrence noticed that essay, Ian Forster noticed that essay, and then in the teens and the 20s, Moby Dick actually re-entered American consciousness, and all of his books were brought back into print, in which they have stubbornly stuck since then.
So you suspect that if it hadn't been for this used bookstore and random chance, that just wouldn't have happened.
It's a very good argument for used bookstores, isn't it?
Emily Dickinson, she relied basically, posthumously, on her sister.
Her sister was the one person that seemed to understand what she was up to. And the woman who wound up editing Emily Dickinson's poems never met her face to face. And Emily Dickinson would write poems up in the attic while this woman would play the piano downstairs. And they would leave gifts for each other at the top and bottom of the stairs, but they never actually met. And when Emily Dickinson died, this woman, Mabel Todd, just out of sheer devotion, and Lavinia Dickinson, Emily Dickinson's sister, pressured every New England literary figure they could think of to put these poems out there. And just like Melville, she was doing something so utterly new that people just were unable aesthetically to recognize that this was great. Houghton Mifflin had the poem sent to them, the great Boston publisher, and they were returned as too queer to publish. When the poems finally were published, the public instantly recognized that this was something spectacular.
And perhaps one of the greatest lessons of your essay is that these chaotic forces that determine the fate of an artistic work have always been with us. And you cite Aristophanes, who lost a contest but won immortality.
Yes. Aristophanes, The Clouds, placed third to two other plays in this dramatic contest. However, the two plays that we know were judged to be, quote, better than Aristophanes' play, they were like dust in the wind. We have no idea what happened to them. They don't exist anymore. And it's just sheer chance that any of Aristophanes' plays survived. I mean, most of them didn't. The ones we have no idea if they're his stinkers.
The good stuff doesn't always rise to the top.
No, and I'd like to imagine an alien civilization who has only, say, The Firm, Sidney Sheldon's collected works, and the Book of Mormon to determine what we were like today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Tom Bissell's book is called Magic Hours.
At home, sitting in my favorite savory nook. My girl's trying to get me eat some dinner she cooked. I'm reading a book, girl, I'm reading a book. Don't you ever interrupt me while I'm reading a book.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Doug Anderson, with more help from Lita Martinez and Ariel Stuhlberg. And it was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. We had engineering help from Andrew Dunn.
Catcher Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.